once more unto the breach, dear friends.
Else fill the wall up with our English dead.
Contrary to popular belief, we are on the air.
That's cool.
Yes, if it was popular belief to begin with, which would have to mean that we were at least popular enough to have a belief about us. No, that's not been us forever. So,
well, I'm listening to KTEM at the same time.
But that is it's got a delay where you're listening to it.
Mm-hmm. So, well, we'll see. But the music went off and no voices came on.
So we'll see.
Yeah. Could be we're on the air. Could be we're not on the air.
This is the Personal Wealth Coach. Whether or not we're on the air, we are the Personal Wealth Coach. And please let us know if we're on the air. Send us an email at Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com. In the meantime, we've got some disclosures to do, so we might as well just jump into those. The Personal Wealth Coach is the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm, as well as this radio program. And the, well, I'm not sure we're on the air. We'll see.
Well, at least on the internet, we're not on the air. Maybe somebody would email us and say, hey, you're on the broadcast, but you're not on the internet. But the music was on, and it's not on now, so I don't think we're on the air.
Okay.
But so we can keep on disclosing.
Yeah, we'll keep disclosing. Just because we're registered with the SEC doesn't mean that the SEC cares much about us in any way, shape, or form, except to tell us when things are not going well. Let's see. We said SEC registered. We said that it's the SEC doesn't care about us. This is an educational radio program. Even though we just said that we are registered with the SEC to give fiduciary advice, we can't do that on the air. This air is educational, not advisorial. Is that a word? Advisorial?
I guess that's a good word.
I just
that's
made a good it up. Word. But you can deem to give us the next disclosure now if you wish.
Well, the information we provide on this educational radio program has been obtained from sources that we deem to be reliable, but we make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or completeness of said information.
It sounded like instead of obtain, you said abstain, which would be fantastically reversing the entire disclosure. Philip, thank you for letting us know that we are on the air. We appreciate you, and we appreciate that you allow your offspring to listen to two bald people occasionally. Thank you for your thank you as well. So we're going to jump right into this now that we're about 15 minutes into the hour. What happened in the market this week?
Well, the market went up and the market went down, and then the market went up a little bit more and then it went down a little more.
All right. And now we're done with the market news and on to the weather. In some places it rained and some places it did not. And now on to sports. The team with the most points won. Yes.
Right.
All right. Back
to you. Actually, the S&P 500 turned into a pretty good week. It rose 2.55% for the week to 3961.63. Just, you know, if you ever want to play around with numbers, which we geeks and nerds do, 2.55% multiply it times 52 weeks, and you go, wow.
Well, that's impressive. But it's not very realistic.
That's why we object to the GDP numbers, by the way. The GDP number that comes out, like the 6 point whatever we had in the fourth quarter GDP last year.
6.9%.
That's an annualized rate.
But it sounds like the quarter did that. It's reported in a quarter, isn't it?
I don't like annualized rates. I think they ought to say how much it rose or fell in that quarter, not annualizing it.
You should project your stay in Vegas based on your, when you get a winning, project it out as if each day will be winning like that.
How about each time you pull the handle?
Yeah, and that way you will fund Las Vegas for the next millennia.
Which, by the way,
the future forever.
Which, by the way, dates me, because I understand you don't pull the handle anymore, you just press a button, because pulling the handle was too much work for the little old ladies or something. Anyway,
Bob, thanks for letting us know. By the way, we've got another confirmation that not only are we on the airwaves, we're on the internet waves, so things are
cool.
Good.
That's good. Okay, the index is now 8%. This S&P 500 is now 8% higher than at its bottom base back in June 16th. It was at 30. You can remember this number. This may be the bottom for this bottom.
Bottom is repetitive emphasis.
Yeah, but it's a cool number. It's 3666.77, which probably has some deep
meta evil
physical meaning or something. Anyway, it's still the S&P 500 end of the week down 17.35% from its top in about the 4th of January.
It up 8% from the bottom, down 17 from the top. Okay.
Yeah. And it is down 16.88% from a year ago. Those are all interesting statistics. But if you go back 3 years, which is the shortest time period, I think a true investor would be in the market, it's up 28%. So that's really good. It's still that, which that 28% is pretty close to its long-term average. So the market really isn't, if you're a long-term investor, the market really isn't down, no matter what the media says, and such, that's life. Anyway, that's the way U.S. equity markets work. Since World War II particularly, and actually over the longer term, if you want to look really long-term, anytime the market is down short-term, if you look back just a few years, it's up from just a few years ago. Why is that an important thing? Because if you are an investor in equities, or if you actually are an investor in any liquid market, it's important that you recognize when you invest, it is long-term or else not investment, it's speculation. And if you look long-term and say, we're up long-term, then you're still probably in the right place. You know, these things change, but it's something to keep your eye on. Is this the bottom? Was June 16th the bottom of this bear market? Who knows? Maybe. I'd say there's a coin flip chance.
I would call it a bottom at the very least.
Mm-hmm. There's about half the people who comment on these things.
These are things that economists can get away with saying. If most people went around calling things bottoms and saying at the very least that's a bottom, and the people would get rather upset. But with us, they're like, I guess when you're dredging a channel, it's okay to say it too. But
and the bottom of a ship.
Yes. That is a bottom. I think they call that the keel. But
or the hull or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Was that the bottom? About half the people who comment on these things can come up with some amazing statistical information to show, yep, that was the bottom. And the other half are saying amazing list of statistical data that says, nope, that wasn't the bottom. It's got at least one more down leg before it's the bottom.
I'll be able to tell you with absolute assurity.
At some point in the future.
Yeah, it may be a year from now, but I'll be able to tell you with absolute assurity at that point whether that was the bottom of this particular.
And my gut reaction is pretty much with the analysts. It's about a 75% feeling like it's the bottom, about 25% saying, no, that ain't the bottom yet. This particular bear market and this particular economic situation we're in, it's certainly not unique in history, but it is very different from others that we have seen in the last half century or so. And I really hate to say it's different this time, but it is different because we have different origins.
It's always different this time. We just have to find the thing that it's like, that it's not so different from. And we can still find those.
But we have to look a long ways into the past to see this.
Yeah. So this
is like the end of World War II or something.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a lot of factors going on in this particular bear market, if we have a recession, in this potential recession in the economy of the United States, and we get into this in detail, and of course it's affecting the markets. There's just a lot of things that are happening right now that we have not seen in some cases for 100 years. So, and we don't have really, really good records of the details of 100 years ago. So we're kind of, it's like you're in a ship and you're cruising through a bunch of islands, and the newest chart you have for where the reefs are and where the rocks are and so on is 100 years old. You
might want to control your speed and make sure your draft is as shallow as possible for a little bit.
Yeah, it's basically be cautious, but don't be panicked. Anyway, the other index we follow, the CRSP Mid-Cap Value Index, closed at 2312.19. Why do we follow Mid-Cap Value? Because the S&P 500 is dominated by large capitalization companies, and tends to be dominated by growth companies. So going to the other corner, if you will, of the stock market, because everybody's not invested in the S&P 500, We look at mid-cap value, and it is up 2.53% for the week. This is the RSP mid-cap value index. It's down just under 11% from its top in January, and it remains down only 4.26% from this time last year. The 10-year U.S. Treasury note has been slipping downward for a couple of weeks now. It's at 2.761. You may remember that a couple of weeks ago, it was at over 3%.
Yeah, and we wanted to make sure you understood that it was the yield, the interest rate that's right. slipping downward.
Right.
Not the Treasury note itself that can be taped to a surface so it doesn't slip around, but the yield on it has slipped down. Yes, go ahead.
Unlike stocks, right? Stocks, which if you've got livestock, you have to pin them in, or they do wander around.
And slippage is important for a lot of reasons.
Basically, if there's a lot of reasons that yields are falling, one of them is the fact that when people buy Treasuries, if a lot of money is buying any bond, the price of the bond goes up and the yield goes down. And the dollar has risen dramatically in the last short period of time and in the last several months, which means a lot of people around the world are buying U.S. Treasuries, and a large part of that U.S. Treasury purchase pressure is coming from outside the United States. People are looking around and saying, this is a very uncertain world. We want to put our money someplace that is safe and reliable. And they're not putting it in gold. They're putting it in U.S. dollars. And there's a very good reason they're not putting it in gold, by the way. If Russia holds a lot of gold. Matter of fact, they're a major gold producer. If they get into serious economic trouble, they will proceed to sell a lot of gold, which means the price of gold will drop, which means if you buy gold thinking there's a crisis right now, and Russia decides to dump all its gold on the market, you will be in a great deal of financial pain. So they're buying dollars, and dollars actually hold up a lot better than gold anyway. The collective wisdom of the bond market either is that inflation's not too bad in the future, or there's just a lot of people buying bonds, which means, I think, the second one. We have a minor inversion in the yield curve. The 2-year, the one to watch in the bond market for an inversion in the yield curve, is you look at the 2-year rate, which is 2.920, and the 10-year rate, which is 2.761. If the 2-year rate is higher than the 10-year rate, then the bond market is considered to be in an inversion. If it stays in an inversion for an extended period of time, it is forecasting a recession. Now, it's pretty clear that the difference between if we round these off, 2.8 and 2.9, is not a lot, which means it's a very mild inversion, which means if it is forecasting a recession, it is forecasting a mild recession. Now, let me add a little caveat here. The bond market inverts mildly many times when there are no recessions coming. The one thing, what is dependable is we never have a recession without a bond market inversion. But we can have a bond market inversion without a recession. So we still don't know whether we're going to have a recession.
Yeah, the longer that inversion stays, the more likely we are to have a recession.
Yeah. And that's
based on history. There mm-hmm. are reasons for that. Yeah.
Well, actually, legally, properly, I think we should say, the longer the bond market has stayed inverted historically, the more likely we were to have had a recession.
Correct. Yes.
It's not a forecast of the future.
It's good, but it's kind of like looking at people can have a fever without having to have an appendix surgery.
Or COVID.
So you gotta look at the symptom as a symptom. And it is a symptom, and it's a symptom of not good health.
And here's something good. West Texas Intermediate crude oil, WTI, dropped 2.7% after dropping about 6% last week. It's down to $94.92 a barrel, which is, interestingly enough, below the forecast price that was out there 6 months ago, which was before Russia invaded Ukraine. In other words, the price of oil has come down to about where the markets were thinking it would be in the summertime if Russia had not invaded Ukraine, which is cool. The national average price of gasoline is now $4.41 a gallon across the nation, according to American Automobile Association. It was over $5 a gallon a month ago. And in Texas, for those of you who, Central Texas specifically, for those of you who track such things, The average price is now $3.84 a gallon, which is making probably a lot of people a lot happier than they were. You can judge the happiness of people. There's a sign that's all over the highway. You see it all up and down the highways, and you can tell exactly how happy people are by reading the sign. It's an inverse relationship. The lower the numbers on the signs at the gas stations, the happier people are.
Yes.
So that's a happiness sign. It's an inversion happiness sign.
Unless you're the small business owner that owns the gas station, and then you've just bought a bunch of gas because people were using it as fast as they could because the prices kept going up. You bought a bunch of gas at that high price, and now you got to eat through that before you can lower your price tag to keep up with the chain next door. Just keep that
there's
in mind.
A chain next door?
Yeah, usually there's a chain. It's like a lot of links held together. No, I mean, a chain gas station versus... And chains, by the way, run into hundreds of gas stations, not thousands. There aren't that many really big chains of gas stations. Most of the oil companies are not in gas stations. So most of those are small business owned. Some of them are medium-sized business owned. And that means that the ones that are the slowest to raise their prices are also the slowest to drop their prices because they have the least amount of volume going through there. They have a big reserve in the ground of stuff they bought at high prices right now. It's going to take them a while to bring their prices down. But the places that are using the gas fast are showing their prices drop quickly. There. That was a quick answer to a question nobody asked.
Mm-hmm. Well, by the way, the wholesale market for gasoline in the United States, it's selling, if you're monster wholesale, like the open market where gasoline immediate contract futures are being traded, is like $3.03 a gallon.
Yeah.
So if you could buy, if you want to buy gasoline at the Chicago board, or the, of course, I'm sorry, the NYMEX, if you want to go to New York and buy gasoline on the futures market to put in your car,
you could save a lot of money.
It'd be $3.03 a gallon. However,
you'd have to take a large quantity.
Yeah, well, you'd have to have a really big tank in your car. I think it's 10,000 gallons is the smallest.
The tank may be significantly larger than the car.
Right.
Yeah.
And that would probably affect your gas mileage.
Yes, it would, probably. So you would probably not net a gain on that if you were to.
Your mileage will vary.
All right. So was that the market?
That was the market.
Well,
there's actually lots more to it than that, but right. We didn't.
We have some questions that are hanging out there from Inquisitor John. Thank you, John. We highly appreciate your ongoing trivial pursuit. The need to know this stuff and to let people understand the complexity in some kind of simplified form. I'll ask the question for him, and you said you were interested in this particular one, so... He, as is tradition, Inquisitor John, has a digital picture of the paper version of the Wall Street Journal with a circled in ink paragraph. We have the name of the article, Investors Pile into Fixed Annuities, which just sounds uncomfortable to me. If you're piling into anything, it's they're not accommodating with, it sounds like an airplane. Yeah, a commercial airplane. You just pile in there. Okay, so that's the headline. His question is, are these front-end loaded like a traditional annuity? And then his paragraph that he has circled is, fixed-rate deferred annuity contracts typically run 3 to 5 years. Interest accumulates at a set rate, akin to a bank certificate of deposit. Do you have an alarm button that we could just... Comparing a certificate of deposit at a bank... A certificate of deposit at a bank is insured by the FDIC.
FDIC.
This is not a risky thing, and that's why interest rates are low there. It's kind of like saying crypto bank accounts will let you make 14% a month, and why would I put it in the bank? Well, because your crypto bank account might not be there next month. FDIC is important, and interest rates, the higher they are, the more the risk. I'm sorry, I'm answering the question instead of you. I need to finish the paragraph, but I couldn't read that on the air without my tongue nearly got bitten in half. I'm sorry. For now, at least, the annuities in general are paying substantially higher yields than bank CDs, according to financial advisors. Do you want to take this question? His question is, Are these front-end loaded like a traditional annuity?
Yes and no. In many cases, if you buy, well, let me put it this way. There's a commission paid on most annuities by most companies to salespersons on short-term fixed annuities. It's not a huge commission because it's a short-term thing in that. But if you buy a three-year annuity, for example, and it's those are called tax-deferred immediate, not immediate, but tax-deferred annuities, and you liquidate at 18 months, you will pay a surrender charge. Now, is there a load in the sense that the person who sold it to you gets paid a commission? Yes. You're not getting all the return. The annuity company decides how much they're going to pay, the interest rate they're going to pay. They have a portfolio of investments or bonds, and they're going to pay you something, obviously. And then they're going to figure out how to earn interest on your money that's higher than what they're paying you. And in many cases, not in all cases, they're also going to pay a commission to the salesperson or the sales company that sold it to you. It's pretty complex and it is not based on market rates, so it's a little hard to get your mind around. And they're also not transparent. You don't know what's going on inside. It's strictly what the annuity company decided to pay you. Now, here's the threat. It hasn't happened yet recently. It did happen in the past. And I've been in this business now for 40 years, so I've seen it happen. When a life insurance company is short on cash flow and they need money quick, they need some money to pay the light bill or whatever, a quick way to get that money is the same way that banks and savings and loans got the money during the crisis. They will go to market and advertise a higher rate for a short-term deposit. During the financial, during the back in the dark ages when banks and saving, during the savings and loan crisis, savings and loans and banks were in a race to offer higher short-term CD rates.
So this was going through the 1970s into the 80s. Interest rates actually were crazy high, and then it culminated in the early 1990s.
In the early 1990s, interest rates had been coming down. People were looking for the high interest rates they got when inflation was really high. And the savings and loans started getting in trouble over the fact that they invested a lot of money in real estate that was cratering, and they needed some cash flow. So they would go to market with and advertise a short-term CD, 2 years, 3 year CD, at a higher rate than anybody else was offering, and the money would come flowing in. Now, banks and savings and loans basically don't do that too much anymore because the regulators finally figured out that was kind of dumb.
And those of them that were doing it generally fell flat on their faces and didn't get back up again.
But very few people remember that, so I'm sure we'll do it again at some point. If an insurance company is short on cash flow, if they're having some financial difficulties, they will go out there with short-term annuity rates that are higher than anybody else is offering. And therein is the risk, because if that insurance company becomes insolvent during, let's say you got a three-year fixed rate annuity, and that insurance company were to become insolvent during the 3 years, you would be an unsecured creditor.
Just to kind of back this up, because people often say, well, aren't there regulations that say how much they're required to hold? Like banks have reserve requirements, don't insurance companies? Yes, they do. But they're set at the state level. They're not consistent from state to state. And quite often what is considered a reserve would in no way be able to act as a reserve at a bank. It's some kind of longer term investment, sometimes higher risk things. So this is a buyer beware situation that most of the people that buy this, they're not aware at all. Anyway, back to you.
So the sale of annuities in most cases is exactly that. It isn't people saying, hey, I want to buy an annuity. In most cases, it is driven by marketing and salespeople, and they really have to have commissions to cause the salespeople to want to sell them. And so, yeah, there's a front load. It's just invisible inside of it.
It's called the back load.
If you surrender your annuity, which is what it's called when you liquidate it, before it's contracted maturity date, you will not get all your money back. And that's because some of it was paid to some organization that was selling it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they're kind of front-loaded.
You just don't experience it till the back end.
I want to emphasize something here. The Wall Street Journal article that John sent, as Jake mentioned a few minutes ago, compared them to certificates of deposit. Don't do that. Don't compare them in your mind to certificates of deposit. If the bank were, first, the banks are heavily regulated. Insurance companies are nowhere near, they're not federally regulated, and they're regulated by the states, and they're looked at once a year, whether they need it or not. And they have, in the past, we have seen annuity companies go under suddenly, and people lose a lot of money. At the bank, or at your credit union or savings and loan, they have a federal deposit insurance program of some kind, and they're about as risk-free as you can get outside of short-term treasuries. And there's a world of difference. And Jake mentioned this earlier. The reason annuities offer a higher interest rate than bank CDs fundamentally is because they carry a higher risk of default.
They don't want to pay you more money than they have to. Nobody does. So why are they paying you more than somebody else? Well, because they need it more, because they have a riskier environment, or because their access to the market is limited. Those are risk meters. If you see something that someone says this is utterly guaranteed, but it's paying a higher risk than that other guaranteed thing over there, it's probably because its guarantee isn't as good as that other thing over there. Otherwise, they wouldn't be paying you that higher interest rate. They don't do it out of the goodness of their hearts. Just say, look, I'll give you more money than them. They're not in competition with that other group. Except technically they are, as soon as it appears in the Wall Street Journal like this, of, oh, well, these are equivalent. They are not equivalent. Anyway, you got us on a soapbox. We are not fans of comparing the two. Annuities have a place. They're a very different tool than a certificate of deposit. Extremely different. They shouldn't, even in short-term ones, we don't consider them savings vehicles. We consider them investment vehicles. Those are different things. One is safe and one is taking risks. And in academia, if you get a return above the bank's return, above the zero risk return, that's called a risk premium. You're being paid money for the extra risk that you're taking. That's true across all products, everything, everywhere, because nobody wants to pay you more than they have to get the money from you. That's just universal. Insurance companies don't love you more than banks do. Crypto companies don't love you more than banks do. There. Banks don't love you. They don't either. There, I've said my piece. Have we wrapped up that one?
Typically, well, based on my experience as a broker, and as far as I can tell from my research, it hasn't changed much. If you bought $100,000 10-year fixed rate annuity, then the broker, the person who's selling it to you, would get typically $3,000 in commission. So it's not a front load. But the load is there. Now, can you do better than that? One of the things, again, and I've said this to again and again and again, and this is important. If you're going to guarantee a loss, let's say you bought a 3-year fixed rate annuity and you're looking at that, two things are important. Number one, at the end of the 3 years, you're going to pay taxes on the interest if you liquidate it. If you are under 59.5 and you do that, you'll pay taxes plus a 10% penalty on the interest at the end of 3 years. If you go to the Treasury, United States Treasury, if you want absolute security, go to the UnitedTreasuryDirect.gov and they will tell you what they will sell you a 3-year Treasury note for. And you buy it and there's no risk, there's no commission. And generally speaking, you will find that the 3-year rate is about the same as that annuity rate. And it's just a lot safer.
And we've got a question that just came in on the Series I bonds from the U.S. Treasury that week. And this is from Alan. We'll wrap this into the conversation. We got to play some commercials shortly, so this won't be long. We said go to TreasuryDirect.gov. Look there. See what their rates are. TreasuryDirect.gov is a great place. It's directly from the government. Alan says, Jeff, Jake, went to the website to look at I-bonds, but couldn't find what happens if you had to sell earlier than a year. What would happen? Well, a Series I-bond is paying a really high interest rate right now based on what the inflation rate is. And the reason why you couldn't find what would happen if you sold earlier than a year is because you simply cannot sell earlier than a year. They don't let you. That money is locked away. It is not in your control for a year. That's something to be aware of. They're paying like 9.6% till December. And then that'll be updated at that point in December with the new rate based on what inflation is running at that point. And if, as we expect, we still have high inflation, it should be a really high number again. Now, you lose a quarter of interest payment if you sell between the one-year point and the five-year point. So keep that in mind. There's pieces of this that are important. But if you have a 9.6% interest rate that's paid out for 6 months, that's better than anything a bank is paying for a whole year, even if you lose a quarter's interest at the year point for liquidating. So just be aware of that. And there's no way to lose principal. If you dump that Series I bond at the 12-month one-day point, you get all of your money that you put in there back because you're selling it directly back to the U.S. government. An annuity, we were just saying that's not the case. So we've got another question that's hanging out there. We got to play some commercials first. It is one that tickled my brain, and I really look forward to answering it. It's about one of the new Federal Reserve and what their tools are, and it's from Inquisitor John once more. We'll get to that after we play commercials. If you would like to join the conversation, the email addresses in here are jeff@tpwc.com and jake@tpwc.com. That's Tango Papa Whiskey Charlie or The Personal Wealth Coach. And we will be back on the other side of these imminently important messages from our sponsors. And we're back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach starring Jake and
Jeff McClure.
We are answering a question now from Inquisitor John. It's a great one. It has to do with the Federal Reserve. Again, he has sent us an article, a picture of the Wall Street Journal through email. The headline is Rate Rise of 0.75 Point is Teed Up. And then down below, there's a circled thing in the article saying this is the largest increase since the last one, 7.75% increase, was the largest since 1994. We're about to do another one, so that will be the largest since last month, which was the largest since 1994. The Fed hasn't raised rates by a full percentage point since it began using the federal funds rate as its primary policy setting tool in the early 90s. John's question is, what did they use prior to this new tool? And why did they change from the old tool? Good question. In the early 90s, something important was happening. Some people called it the beginning of the digital revolution. Banks were becoming digitized. You'll notice this was also the time period that ATMs started popping up and you could actually talk to an automated teller rather than a teller. And you could push buttons and it would give you money. It's because computers started to be used to keep track of interest rates and a lot of other things. So it isn't that they didn't set this rate. This is their interbank tool. It's what all the headlines are about now when they raise and lower interest rates. They still did that back then. It isn't like it was a new tool. in the 1990s when they started using it. They just could charge different amounts to different banks. They didn't announce what their target was. They didn't tell anybody what they were charging, including other banks about the other banks. So some banks they might charge a higher amount to than other banks, which is a little strange. Well, as the 90s hit and computers started being there, they could unify that a lot easier. The way the Federal Reserve works is a giant network, but the network gets more complex at the bottom end. You've got Federal Reserve banks that are stashed around the country, and they're in charge of monitoring a whole series of banks in their area. If you think about the calculators that used to have to be used to figure out who had deposits where at the Federal Reserve level, they were running days and days and days behind on what amount was due and what it's just the way the world used to work. If there was no change to it, they had a pretty good printout of what was owed by what person. But it's sitting in a book, a ledger book, and they have to look up and write in that ledger book anytime a payment came in from a bank or anytime a charge went to a bank or came back. It's very different now. The complexity of being able to change the Federal Reserve funds rate is much simpler now that we have computers. It's not that it's less complicated, but the computers do all the work for us. So it isn't that it's a new tool at this point. It just became a lot easier to use. We've talked about the Federal Reserve has a couple of big sledgehammer tools that they're allowed to use to fight inflation. There's lots of nuances on what causes inflation. There's just some really big tools to fight them. They used to do most of their inflation fighting directly on the open market. They would go and buy bonds, U.S. Treasury bonds, from banks, usually Federal Reserve banks. One of the big problems that occurred on 9/11 is that the John says we're on the air, by the way.
Good.
The one of the big problems on 9/11 is that several of the big bond buying firms that were hit and disappeared were the ones that were tapped by the Federal Reserve to buy the bonds on the open market or sell it. There's an extra layer of secrecy involved there. So they had to scramble hard to find someone else to buy and sell the bonds for them, part of the reason why the market was just shut down for so long. So this isn't a new tool that was devised in the 90s, but it became a much more accurate tool. Even now, when they raise and lower interest rates, there's an error in the average of 10 basis points. That's 10/100ths of a percent, 10% of a percent. And where's that from? Well, it's because payments come in at different times from different places. That's not a lot of difference, but it's enough that we're still not absolutely accurate. When you're buying on the open market, the Federal Reserve doesn't know how much they're changing the interest rate by buying a bunch of bonds. They have to look at it over the next couple of days to see what did that do. Where if you change the federal funds rate, it changes a lot. Now, I'm going to tack on to that another thing that is a absolutely brand new tool being used by a central bank this week. It's not a measurement tool. It's an actual inflation and recessionary fighting sort of tool. The European Central Bank just raised interest rates this week by 0.5%, 0.5%. Do you know what their bank what their interest rate is now? Their equivalent of the Fed funds rate. They just raised it 0.5% to zero. Yeah, they've been having a negative 0.5% rate on savings. They're actually paying banks to give them loans. It's very interesting. So now we're back to zero in the Eurozone. So they're fighting inflation there. They're doing it the same way we do. But when they raised the rate, something fascinating happened. Italy and Greece, you remember the whole thing about Grexit and their debt problem? This was a long time ago. I know it's more than a year ago. Most people have forgotten that. But the Brexit got its name because the Greeks were trying to do it first, and they couldn't because they had too much debt, and they would have to change their euro debt, and it was very bad. They still have a lot of debt. So does Italy. Most of the southern European countries are not as fiscally responsible as the northern European countries. So when the European Central Bank raises the rates for the, basically for the banks on their reserve requirements, each country's rates get affected differently. And though it sounded like a balloon was being rubbed in the background, mm-hmm. you were sipping from your coffee, which is...
And it rubbed against the microphone.
Okay. I was. You could be a Foley artist. That was quite an interesting sound.
Cool.
Okay, so the Federal Reserve raises their inner funds rate, and then we have to look at the bond market to make sure it doesn't get all messed up. And we have the ability, the Federal Reserve goes out there and buys and sells stuff on the open market to help stabilize that. When the European Central Bank raised rates, the German bonds, the Bunds, didn't move very much. Italian rates went through the roof, which causes a massive drop in the principal value there. The Greek bonds went through the roof, which caused a massive loss on paper to anybody that held it. And so the European Central Bank said, oh, we need, when we're raising rates, we need to somehow keep these countries from going different directions on their interest rates, because we could cause a recession in Italy while the whole European Union is fine. So they came up with a new tool, and they don't have a good name for it yet. They are calling it an anti-fragmentation instrument, which sounds like something that they're sending for Ukrainian defense rather than interest rate changes. What is it? It is essentially the ability to go on the open market and buy a bunch of Italian and Greek bonds when they raise interest rates on everyone, so that the Italians and Greeks don't lose all their money or have to pay exorbitant interest rates for debt that they didn't have to pay exorbitant interest rates a few moments before. They have a more complicated task in preventing recession in Europe than the Federal Reserve does in the United States. And that the Federal Reserve looks around and most of the states in the United States are on pretty good economic footing. Not all of them. Illinois is still pretty messed up. Indiana's not great. But those are considered municipal bonds, and they're treated differently than the United States bonds. In Europe, Italian bonds and German Bunds and Greek, I don't know, it's all Greek to me there, whatever they're called. All of those instruments are still treated as national interests for the country involved. It's a little bit strange. They're a confederation and we're a union. So they've got to build this new tool that hasn't existed before, which if the Germans get to understanding what it is that's happening here, they may be upset about. So expect this to be more in the news as the tool gets trickled out there. There are already strategists that are saying, what do you mean? You're raising interest rates to fight inflation, to pull money out of the economy, but now you're dumping money into Italy, which has a higher inflation rate, even though we're still talking about the euro, than Germany does. You have something to add?
One of the things that's high on the uncertainty index right now, and one of the things I do want to talk about is, are we going to have a recession? Are we in a recession? How is a recession figured? It's important to recognize that Italy is the third largest economy in the Eurozone, and its government just collapsed.
Yeah.
It also is the most indebted. It's actually more indebted than the Greeks are at this point.
Yeah, by percentage and by total amount.
And so if it wasn't for the Russian invasion of Ukraine, we would consider this to be a crisis like the Greek crisis at this point. But since we've got other bigger crises going on, and we're out of time for the first hour, so we want to say this is the Personal Wealth Coach. And
we will talk about the Italian situation more next hour.
And recessions.
Yeah. If you'd like to talk to us off the air, we have local voicemail available at
254-947-1111.
That becomes real life people during the week. Just weekends, it's not so much. You can reach that same line at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can also go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can contact us through the contact form. You can email us at Jake or Jeff at tpwc.com. On the website, we have lots of newsletters going back. You can sign up to receive it individually through email. We've got radio programs going back into the distant past, and you can go anywhere podcasts are available to find us under TPWC. Until next hour, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach. Thank you very much for listening.